He saw the getting away with it look on their faces, a peculiar look that seemed secretive yet resentful, as if, incredibly, it were he who was hiding some secret from them.
"I don't see why you should choose to take such a defeatist view of the situation," said Mooch sullenly.
"Defeatist? Do you really expect me to be able to remain in business under your plan?
But it's only temporary."
"There is no such thing as a temporary suicide."
"But it's only for the duration of the emergency, only until the country recovers."
"How do you expect it to recover?" There was no answer. "How do you expect me to produce after I go bankrupt?"
"You won't go bankrupt. You'll always produce,"
said Dr. Ferris indifferently, neither in praise nor in blame, merely in the tone of stating a fact of nature, as he would have said to another man, "You'll always be a bum." "You can't help it. It's in your blood. Or, to be more scientific, you're conditioned that way." Reardon sat up. It was as if he had been struggling to find the secret combination of a lock, and felt at those words a faint click within, as of the first tumbler falling into place.
"It's only a matter of weathering this crisis," said Mooch, "of giving people a reprieve, a chance to catch up."
"And then?"
"Then things will improve."
"How?" There was no answer. "What will improve them?" There was no answer. "Who will improve them?"
"Christ, Mr. Reardon, people don't just stand still," cried Holloway. "They do things, they grow, they move forward."
"What people?" Holloway waved his hand vaguely.
"People," he said.
"What people? The people to whom you're going to feed the last of Reardon's steel without getting anything in return? The people who will go on consuming more than they produce?"
"Conditions will change."
"Who will change them?" There was no answer. "Have you anything left to loot? If you didn't see the nature of your policy before, it's not possible that you don't see it now. Look around you. All those damned people's states all over the earth have been existing only on the handouts which you squeezed for them out of this country. But you have no place left to sponge on or mooch from. No country on the face of the globe. This was the greatest and last. You've drained it. You've milked it dry. Of all that irretrievable splendor, I'm only one remnant. The last. What will you do, you and your people's globe, after you've finished me? What are you hoping for? What do you see ahead, except plain, stark animal starvation?" They did not answer. They did not look at him. Their faces wore expressions of stubborn resentment, as if his were the plea of a liar. Then Lawson said softly, half in reproach, half in scorn, "Well, after all, you businessmen have kept predicting disasters for years. You've cried catastrophe at every progressive measure and told us that we'll perish.
But we haven't."
He started to smile, but drew back from the sudden intensity of Reardon's eyes. Reardon had felt another click in his mind, the sharper click of the second tumbler connecting the circuits of the lock. He leaned forward.
"What are you counting on?"
he asked. His tone had changed. It was low. It had the steady, pressing, droning sound of a drill.
"It's only a matter of gaining time," cried Mooch.
"There isn't any time left to gain."
"All we need is a chance," cried Lawson.
"There are no chances left."
"It's only until we recover," cried Holloway.
"There is no way to recover."
"Only until our policies begin to work,"
cried Dr. Ferris.
"There is no way to make the irrational work."
There was no answer.
"What can save you now?"
"Oh, you'll do something," cried James Taggart.
Then, even though it was only a sentence he had heard all his life, he felt a deafening crash within him as of a steel door dropping open at the touch of the final tumbler, the one small number completing the sum and releasing the intricate lock, the answer uniting all the pieces, the questions, and the unsolved wounds of his life. In the moment of silence after the crash, it seemed to him that he heard Francisco's voice, asking him quietly in the ballroom of this building, yet asking it also here and now, "Who is the guiltiest man in this room?" He heard his own answer of the past.
"I suppose James Taggart?"
And Francisco's voice saying without reproach, "No, Mr. Reardon, it's not James Taggart." But here in this room, in this moment, his mind answered,
"I am."
He had cursed these looters for their stubborn blindness? It was he who had made it possible. From the first extortion he had accepted, from the first directive he had obeyed, he had given them cause to believe that reality was a thing to be cheated, that one could demand the irrational, and someone somehow would provide it. If he had accepted the Equalization of Opportunity Bill, if he had accepted Directive 10-289, if he had accepted the law that those who could not equal his ability had the right to dispose of it, that those who had not earned were to profit, but he who had was to lose, that those who could not think were to command, but he who could was to obey them, then were they illogical in believing that they existed in an irrational universe? He had made it for them. He had provided it. Were they illogical in believing that theirs was only to wish with no concern for the possible, and that his was to fulfill their wishes by means they did not have to know or name? They, the impotent mystics, struggling to escape the responsibility of reason, had known that he, the rationalist, had undertaken to serve their whims. They had known that he had given them a blank check on reality. His was not to ask why. Theirs was not to ask how. Let them demand that he give them a share of his wealth. Then all that he owns. Then more than he owns. Impossible? No. He'll do something. He did not know that he had leaped to his feet, that he stood staring down at James Taggart, seeing in the unbridled shapelessness of Taggart's features the answer to all the devastation he had witnessed through the years of his life. "What's the matter, Mr. Reardon? What have I said?" Taggart was asking with rising anxiety, but he was out of reach of Taggart's voice. He was seeing the progression of the years, the monstrous extortions, the impossible demands, the inexplicable victories of evil, the preposterous plans and unintelligible goals proclaimed in volumes of muddy philosophy, the desperate wonder of the victims who thought that some complex malevolent wisdom was moving the powers, destroying the world. And all of it had rested on one tenet, behind the shifty eyes of the victors. He'll do something. We'll get away with it. He'll let us. He'll do something. You businessmen kept predicting that we'd perish, but we haven't. It was true, he thought. They had not been blind to reality. He had. Blind to the reality he himself had created. No, they had not perished. But who had? Who had perished to pay for their manner of survival? Ellis Wyatt, Ken Daniger, Francisco D'Anconia. He was reaching for his hat and coat when he noticed that the men in the room were trying to stop him, that their faces had a look of panic and their voices were crying in bewilderment. "What's the matter, Mr. Reardon? Why? But why? What have we said? You're not going. You can't go. It's too early. Not yet. Oh, not yet!" He felt as if he were seeing them from the rear window of a speeding express, as if they stood on the track behind him, waving their arms in futile gestures and screaming indistinguishable sounds, their figures growing smaller in the distance, their voices fading. One of them tried to stop him as he turned to the door. He pushed him out of his way, not roughly, but with a simple, smooth sweep of his arm, as one brushes aside an obstructing curtain, then walked out. Silence was his only sensation as he sat at the wheel of his car, speeding back down the road to Philadelphia. It was the silence of immobility within him, as if possessing knowledge, he could now afford to rest, with no further activity of soul. He felt nothing, neither anguish nor elation. It was as if, by an effort of years, he had climbed a mountain to gain a distant view, and having reached the top, had fallen to lie still, to rest before he looked, free to spare himself for the first time. He was aware of the long, empty road streaming, then curving, then streaming straight before him, of the effortless pressure of his hands on the wheel, and the screech of the tires on the curves. But he felt as if he were speeding down a skyway, suspended and coiling in empty space. The passers-by at the factories, the bridges, the power plants along his road saw a sight that had once been natural among them, a trim, expensively powerful car driven by a confident man, with the concept of success proclaimed more loudly than by any electric sign, proclaimed by the driver's garments, by his expert steering, by his purposeful speed. They watched him go past and vanish into the haze, equating earth with night. He saw his mills rising in the darkness, as a black silhouette against a breathing glow, The glow was the color of burning gold, and Reardon Steel stood written across the sky in the cool white fire of crystal. He looked at the long silhouette, the curves of blast furnaces standing like triumphal arches, the smokestacks rising like a solemn colonnade along an avenue of honor in an imperial city, the bridges hanging like garlands, the cranes saluting like lances, the smoke waving slowly like flags. The sight broke the stillness within him, and he smiled in greeting. It was a smile of happiness, of love, of dedication. He had never loved his mills as he did in that moment, for, seeing them by an act of his own vision, cleared of all but his own code of values, in a luminous reality that held no contradictions, he was seeing the reason of his love. The mills were an achievement of his mind, devoted to his enjoyment of existence, erected in a rational world to deal with rational men. If those men had vanished, if that world was gone, if his mills had ceased to serve his values, then the mills were only a pile of dead scrap, to be left to crumble the sooner the better, to be left, not as an act of treason, but as an act of loyalty to their actual meaning. The mills were still a mile ahead when a small spurt of flame caught his sudden attention. Among all the shades of fire and the vast spread of structures, he could tell the abnormal and the out of place. This one was too raw a shade of yellow, and it was darting from a spot where no fire had reason to be, from a structure by the gate of the main entrance. In the next instant, he heard the dry crack of a gunshot, then three answering cracks in swift succession, like an angry hand slapping a sudden assailant. Then the black mass, barring the road in the distance, took shape. It was not mere darkness, and it did not recede as he came closer. It was a mob squirming at the main gate trying to storm the mills. He had time to distinguish waving arms, some with clubs, some with crowbars, some with rifles, the yellow flames of burning wood gushing from the window of the gatekeeper's office, the blue cracks of gunfire darting out of the mob, and the answers spitting from the roofs of the structures. He had time to see a human figure twisting backward and falling from the top of a car. Then he sent his wheels into a shrieking curve, turning into the darkness of a side road. He was going at the rate of 60 miles an hour down the ruts of an unpaved soil, toward the eastern gate of the mills, and the gate was in sight when the impact of tires on a gully threw the car off the road to the edge of a ravine where an ancient slag heap lay at the bottom. With the weight of his chest and elbow on the wheel, pitted against 2 tons of speeding metal, the curve of his body forced the curve of the car to complete its screaming half-circle, sweeping it back onto the road and into the control of his hands. It had taken one instant, but in the next his foot went down on the brake, tearing the engine to a stop. For in the moment when his headlights had swept the ravine, he had glimpsed an oblong shape, darker than the gray of the weeds on the slope, and it had seemed to him that a brief white blur had been a human hand waving for help. Throwing off his overcoat, he went hurrying down the side of the ravine, lumps of earth giving way under his feet. He went catching at the dried coils of brush, half running, half sliding toward the long black form, which he could now distinguish to be a human body. A scum of cotton was swimming against the moon. He could see the white of a hand and the shape of an arm lying stretched in the weeds. But the body lay still with no sign of motion.
"Mr. Reardon?"
It was a whisper struggling to be a cry. It was the terrible sound of eagerness fighting against a voice that could be nothing but a moan of pain. He did not know which came first. It felt like a single shock. His thought that the voice was familiar, a ray of moonlight breaking through the cotton, the movement of falling down on his knees by the white oval of a face, and the recognition. It was the wet nurse. He felt the boy's hand clutching his with the abnormal strength of agony, while he was noticing the tortured lines of the face, the drained lips, the glazing eyes, and the thin dark trickle from a small black hole in too wrong, too close a spot, on the left side of the boy's chest.
"Mr. Reardon, I wanted to stop them. I wanted to save you."
"What happened to you, kid?"
"They shot me, so I wouldn't talk. I wanted to prevent..."
His hand fumbled toward the red glare in the sky.
"What they're doing. I was too late, but I've tried to. I've tried, and I'm still able to talk. Listen. They...
You need help. Let's get you to a hospital and...
No, wait. I don't think I have much time left to me, and I've got to tell you. Listen, that riot, it's staged, on orders from Washington. It's not workers, not your workers. It's those new boys of theirs, and a lot of goons hired on the outside. Don't believe a word they'll tell you about it. It's a frame-up. It's their rotten kind of frame-up.
There was a desperate intensity in the boy's face. The intensity of a crusader's battle. His voice seemed to gain a sound of life from some fuel burning in broken spurts within him, and Reardon knew that the greatest assistance he could now render was to listen.
They've got a steel unification plan ready, and they need an excuse for it because they know that the country won't take it, and you won't stand for it. They're afraid this one's going to be too much for everybody. It's just a plan to skin you alive, that's all. So they want to make it look like you're starving your workers, and the workers are running amok and you're unable to control them. And the government's got to step in for your own protection and for public safety. That's going to be their pitch, Mr. Reardon.
Reardon was noticing the torn flesh of the boy's hands, the drying mud of blood and dust on his palms and his clothing, gray patches of dust on knees and stomach, scrambled with the needles of burrs. In the intermittent fits of moonlight, he could see the trail of flattened weeds and glistening smears going off into the darkness below. He dreaded to think how far the boy had crawled, and for how long.
They didn't want you to be here tonight, Mr. Reardon. They didn't want you to see their people's rebellion. Afterwards. You know how they screw up the evidence. There won't be a straight story to get anywhere. And they hope to fool the country. And you... that they're acting to protect you from violence. Don't let them get away with it, Mr. Reardon. Tell the country. Tell the people. Tell the newspapers. Tell them that I told you. It's under oath. I swear it. That makes it legal, doesn't it? Doesn't it? That gives you a chance?
Reardon pressed the boy's hand in his.
Thank you, kid.
I'm sorry I'm late, Mr. Reardon, but they didn't let me in on it till the last minute, till just before it started. They called me in on a strategy conference. There was a man there by the name of Peters from the Unification Board. He's a stooge of Tinky Holloway, who's a stooge of Orrin Boyle. What they wanted from me was... they wanted me to sign a lot of passes, to let some of the goons in, so they'd start trouble from the inside and the outside together. To make it look like they really were your workers. I refused to sign the passes.
You did? After they'd let you in on their game?
But of course, Mr. Reardon. Did you think I'd play that kind of game?
No, kid, no. I guess not. Only...
What?
Only that's when you stuck your neck out.
But I had to. I couldn't help them wreck the mills, could I? How long was I to keep from sticking my neck out? Till they broke yours? And what would I do with my neck if that's how I had to keep it? You understand it, don't you, Mr. Reardon?
Yes, I do.
I refused them. I ran out of the office. I ran to look for the superintendent to tell him everything. But I couldn't find him. And then I heard shots at the main gate, and I knew it had started. I tried to phone your home. The phone wires were cut. I ran to get my car. I wanted to reach you or a policeman or a newspaper or somebody. But they must have been following me. That's when they shot me. In the parking lot. From behind. All I remember is falling and then when I opened my eyes, they had dumped me here. On the slag heap.
On the slag heap? Said Reardon slowly, knowing that the heap was 100 feet below. The boy nodded, pointing vaguely down into the darkness.
Yeah, down there, and then I started crawling up. I wanted to last till I told somebody who'd tell you.
The pain-twisted lines of his face smoothed suddenly into a smile. The voice had the sound of a lifetime's triumph, as he added,
I have.
Then he jerked his head up and asked, in the tone of a child's astonishment at a sudden discovery,
Mr. Reardon? Is this how it feels to want something very much, very desperately much, and to make it?
Yes, kid. That's how it feels. The boy's head dropped back against Reardon's arm, the eyes closing, the mouth relaxing, as if to hold a moment's profound contentment. But you can't stop there. You're not through. You've got to hang on till I get you to a doctor, and...
He was lifting the boy cautiously, but a convulsion of pain ran through the boy's face, his mouth twisting to stop a cry, and Reardon had to lower him gently back to the ground. The boy shook his head with a glance that was almost apology.
I won't make it, Mr. Reardon. No use fooling myself. I know I'm through.
Then, as if by some dim recoil against self-pity, he added, reciting a memorized lesson, his voice a desperate attempt at his old cynical intellectual tone.
What does it matter, Mr. Reardon? Man is only a collection of conditioned chemicals, and a man's dying doesn't make any more difference than an animal's.
You know better than that.
Yes,
he whispered.
Yes, I guess I do.
His eyes wandered over the vast darkness, then rose to Reardon's face. The eyes were helpless, longing, childishly bewildered.
I know. It's crap, all those things they taught us. All of it. Everything they said about living or dying. Dying. It wouldn't make any difference to chemicals, but...
He stopped, and all of his desperate protest was only in the intensity of his voice dropping lower to say,
But it does to me. And I guess it makes a difference to an animal, too. But they said there are no values, only social customs. No values!
His hand clutched blindly at the hole in his chest as if trying to hold that which he was losing.
No. Values.
Then his eyes opened wider, with the sudden calm of full frankness.
I'd like to live, Mr. Reardon. God, how I'd like to.
His voice was passionately quiet.
Not because I'm dying, but because I've just discovered tonight what it means, really, to be alive. And it's funny. Do you know when I discovered it? In the office, when I stuck my neck out, when I told the bastards to go to hell? There's so many things I wish I'd known sooner. But, well, it's no use crying over spilled milk.
He saw Reardon's involuntary glance at the flattened trail below, and added,
Overspilled anything, Mr. Reardon.
Listen, kid, said Reardon sternly, I want you to do me a favor.
Now, Mr. Reardon?
Yes, now.
Why, of course, Mr. Reardon. If I can.
You've done me a big favor tonight, but I want you to do a still bigger one. You've done a great job climbing out of that slag heap. Now will you try for something still harder? You were willing to die to save my mills. Will you try to live for me?
For you, Mr. Reardon?
For me, because I'm asking you to, because I want you to, because we still have a great distance to climb together, you and I.
Does it make a difference to you, Mr. Reardon?
It does. Will you make up your mind that you want to live? Just as you did down there on the slag heap? That you want to last and live? Will you fight for it? You wanted to fight my battle. Will you fight this one with me as our first?
He felt the clutching of the boy's hand. It conveyed the violent eagerness of the answer. The voice was only a whisper.
I'll try, Mr. Reardon.
Now help me to get you to a doctor. Just relax, take it easy, and let me lift you.
Yes, Mr. Reardon.
With the jerk of a sudden effort, the boy pulled himself up to lean on an elbow.
Take it easy, Tony.
He saw a sudden flicker in the boy's face, an attempt at his old, bright, impudent grin.
Not non-absolute anymore?
No, not anymore. You're a full absolute now, and you know it.
Yes. I know several of them now. There's one.
He pointed at the wound in his chest.
That's an absolute, isn't it? And he went on speaking while Reardon was lifting him from the ground by imperceptible seconds and inches, speaking as if the trembling intensity of his words were serving as an anesthetic against the pain. And men can't live if rotten bastards like the ones in Washington get away with things like the one they're doing tonight, if everything becomes a stinking fake, and nothing is real, and nobody is anybody. Men can't live that way. That's an absolute, isn't it?
Yes, Tony, that's an absolute.
Reardon rose to his feet by a long, cautious effort. He saw the tortured spasm of the boy's features as he settled him slowly against his chest, like a baby held tight in his arms. But the spasm twisted him into another echo of the impudent grin, and the boy asked, "Who's the wet nurse now?"
"I guess I am."
He took the first steps up the slant of crumbling soil. His body tensed to the task of shock absorber for his fragile burden, to the task of maintaining a steady progression where there was no foothold to find. The boy's head dropped on Reardon's shoulder hesitantly, almost as if this were a presumption. Reardon bent down and pressed his lips to the dust-streaked forehead. The boy jerked back, raising his head with a shock of incredulous, indignant astonishment.
"Do you know what you did?"
he whispered, as if unable to believe that it was meant for him.
"Put your head down," said Reardon, "and I'll do it again."
The boy's head dropped, and Reardon kissed his forehead. It was like a father's recognition granted to a son's battle. The boy lay still, his face hidden, his hands clutching Reardon's shoulders. Then, with no hint of sound, with only the sudden beat of faint, spaced, rhythmic shudders to show it, Reardon knew that the boy was crying. Crying in surrender, in admission of all the things which he could not put into the words he had never found. Reardon went on moving slowly upward, step by groping step, fighting for firmness of motion against the weeds, the drifts of dust, the chunks of scrap metal, the refuse of a distant age. He went on toward the line where the red glow of his mills marked the edge of the pit above him, his movement a fierce struggle that had to take the form of a gentle, unhurried flow. He heard no sobs, but he felt the rhythmic shudders, and through the cloth of his shirt, in place of tears, he felt the small, warm, liquid spurts flung from the wound by the shudders. He knew that the tight pressure of his arms was the only answer which the boy was now able to hear and understand, and he held the trembling body as if the strength of his arms could transfuse some part of his living power into the arteries beating ever fainter against him. Then the sobbing stopped, and the boy raised his head. His face seemed thinner and paler, but the eyes were lustrous, and he looked up at Reardon, straining for the strength to speak.
"Mr. Reardon,
I liked you very much. I know it."
The boy's features had no power to form a smile, but it was a smile that spoke in his glance as he looked at Reardon's face, as he looked at that which he had not known he had been seeking through the brief span of his life, seeking as the image of that which he had not known to be his values. Then his head fell back, and there was no convulsion in his face, only his mouth relaxing to a shape of serenity. But there was a brief stab of convulsion in his body, like a last cry of protest. And Reardon went on slowly, not altering his pace, even though he knew that no caution was necessary any longer, because what he was carrying in his arms was now that which had been the boy's teacher's idea of man, a collection of chemicals. He walked as if this were his form of last tribute and funeral procession for the young life that had ended in his arms. He felt an anger, too intense to identify except as a pressure within him. It was a desire to kill. The desire was not directed at the unknown thug who had sent a bullet through the boy's body, or at the looting bureaucrats who had hired the thug to do it, but at the boy's teachers, who had delivered him, disarmed, to the thug's gun, at the soft, safe assassins of college classrooms, who, incompetent to answer the queries of a quest for reason, took pleasure in crippling the young minds entrusted to their care. Somewhere, he thought, there was this boy's mother, who had trembled with protective concern over his groping steps while teaching him to walk, who had measured his baby formulas with a jeweler's caution,
who had obeyed with a zealot's fervor the latest words of science on his diet and hygiene, protecting his unhardened body from germs, then had sent him to be turned into a tortured neurotic by the men who taught him that he had no mind and must never attempt to think. Had she fed him tainted refuse, he thought, had she mixed poison into his food, it would have been more kind and less fatal. He thought of all the living species that train their young in the art of survival, the cats who teach their kittens to hunt, the birds who spend such strident effort on teaching their fledglings to fly. Yet man, whose tool of survival is the mind, does not merely fail to teach a child to think, but devotes the child's education to the purpose of destroying his brain, of convincing him that thought is futile and evil before he has started to think.